The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Diane Edelman for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Reader's Digest. Today's program is supported by the Durham Lions Club. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you mostly from the Reader's Digest, but we will begin with a bonus article from the Saturday Evening Post. The Other Hero of the Hudson. Ferry Captain Vincent Lombardi was mid-crossing toward Manhattan's Pier 79 when routine shattered. From the corner of his eye, he saw something impossible. A plane, low and silent, descending into the Hudson. By Christina Stanton. Most mornings on my commute, I pass the same man moving through Weehawken's Port Imperial Ferry Terminal in a New York waterway uniform. He strides with the clipped urgency of someone late for something important, blending easily into the riverfront rush. Still, there's something about him that makes me look twice. A steadiness, a quiet authority that lingers just long enough to register. One morning, it finally clicks. I don't just recognize the uniform. I recognize him. I've seen his face before. Not on the ferry, but on a movie screen. He appeared in Sully, which tells the astonishing true story of U.S. Airways Flight 1549, the flight that departed LaGuardia and, after a bird strike disabled both engines, was forced into the Hudson River on January 15, 2009. In the film, a ferry captain diverts his boat, steers towards the crippled plane, steadies the rig as passengers are pulled from the freezing water, and carries them safely to shore. The scene feels uncannily real because the man playing the captain isn't an actor. It's Vincent Lombardi playing himself. Most mornings, he's just a guy hustling to keep ferries running smoothly and safely at a busy Weehawken terminal. He blends in easily, another professional moving with purpose. But as the 17th anniversary of the Miracle on the Hudson approaches, what began as recognition hardens into a question I can't shake. Who is he, really? Not the polished version preserved in headlines or film reels, but the human one. The fear, the instincts, the split-second decisions no camera could ever fully capture. After the bruising weight of 2025, I think I was searching for proof that when everything collapses, some people still run toward the crisis. Not for glory, not for credit, but because something deep inside insists it's the right thing to do. One day, I finally stopped him and asked. He was more than generous in his response. Vincent Lombardi, named for his uncle Vincenzo and the legendary football coach, grew up in Montclair, New Jersey, fishing from his father's small boat and learning the language of water early. After high school, he worked armed executive protection for New York's elite, a job that demanded vigilance, restraint, and calm under pressure. Following September 11, 2001, as the city reeled and recalibrated, he was hired to strengthen ferry security, standing watch at the edges of a city, still learning how to feel safe again. That work pulled him in a new direction. Drawn to life on the water, Lombardi set his sights on the wheelhouse. He traveled to Maryland to earn his captain's license, starting as a deckhand and steadily logging the hours, the experience, the trust. By 2003, he had been promoted to captain. Along the way, he worked dinner cruises and party boats, learning to read people as easily as the currents before finally joining New York Waterway. By January 15, 2009, ferry life had settled into routine. At 3:31 p.m., Lombardi was mid-crossing toward Manhattan's Pier 79 when routine shattered. From the corner of his eye, he saw something impossible. A plane, low and silent, descending into the Hudson. Moments earlier, just after takeoff, the aircraft had struck a flock of Canada geese. Both engines failed. Captain Chesley Sully Sullenberger took control as First Officer Jeffrey Skiles worked the restart checklist. The plane climbed briefly, cleared the George Washington Bridge by less than 900 feet, then began to glide. Sullenberger radioed a mayday, assessed his options, and realized they wouldn't make it back to land. "We're going to be in the Hudson," he told air traffic control. Less than 4 minutes later, the plane struck the icy river at 125 knots, 140 miles per hour. Ferry crews are trained for emergencies, but Lombardi and his three-person crew didn't wait for instructions. Without hesitation, he swung the ferry toward the wreckage, announcing over the loudspeaker that they were diverting to assist and asking any able-bodied passengers to help. There was no panic, only purpose. The scale was staggering. 155 people exposed to 19-degree air and 40-degree water. The ebb tide dragged the aircraft downstream, forcing Lombardi to reverse his vessel with surgical precision, close enough to pull survivors aboard, yet far enough to avoid collision. Using a Jason's cradle, deckhands and commuters worked together to bring passengers aboard. "We cleared the wing pretty fast," Lombardi recalls. He then maneuvered toward a life raft to retrieve the remaining passengers. As other boats converged, Lombardi headed straight for Pier 79, knowing that FDNY units were staged there. One flight attendant was bleeding, soaked, and shaking. Others were already slipping into shock and hypothermia. There was no margin for delay. When the ferry docked, firefighters, police officers, and emergency medical teams rushed in. Some passengers were hospitalized, but all 155 survived. Officials called it the Miracle on the Hudson. Federal investigators call it the most successful emergency water landing in history. Only after the last passenger was safely ashore did Lombardi exhale. When asked what stays with him most from that day, he didn't talk about heroism or headlines. With quiet pride and something like awe, he simply said, "I got to make sure all those people made it home to their families." Years later, Hollywood came calling. Lombardi was initially asked to consult on a film about the rescue, but after hearing him tell the story firsthand, director Clint Eastwood made an unexpected decision. Lombardi would play himself. Filming followed in New York and California, an experience Lombardi still describes with disbelief. "I'm just a regular guy from Jersey," he says. "I happened to be in the right place at the right time. And then all these wonderful things happened." These wonderful things included working alongside Eastwood. "He was my childhood hero," Lombardi says. "They shared meals, swapped stories, and talked like everyday people." In those moments, the legendary filmmaker was simply a man, humble, attentive, kind. Sully was released on September 9, 2016, opening at number one and earning $240 million worldwide. But for Lombardi, the meaning wasn't box office success. It was the experience itself, and the chance to see the story told with care. Lombardi has stayed close with passengers and crew ever since. Each year, survivors, flight crew, rescue workers, and FDNY responders gather for an anniversary meal. If Sullenberger can't attend in person, he joins by livestream. Lombardi rarely misses it. He relishes seeing faces he now knows by name, especially co-captain Skiles. "We're both Packer fans," he says, grinning. Today, Lombardi serves as a port captain and marine inspector, overseeing ferry operations and schedules rather than captaining daily crossings. But for all the inspections and routines, one exchange from shortly after the rescue still stays with him, towering above the rest. His grandfather told him he had brought honor to the family name. "I left something for my daughter and future grandkids," Lombardi says, his voice catching. "An honor to our family." In a world that often feels starved for heroes, Vince Lombardi doesn't seek the spotlight. He moves quietly through life. But when the moment demands it, he steps forward, reminding us that courage and compassion still exist, often in the hands of those who simply chose to show up. That was The Other Hero of the Hudson by Christina Stanton in the Saturday Evening Post. And now we turn to the Reader's Digest with two short articles from the nicest places in America. The first one, "Greetings from Peru Amateur Circus," by Carol Fanning. The clownery starts on the sidewalk even before you enter the Big Top. Crowds who show up to see the Peru Amateur Circus in Peru, Indiana, known as America's Circus City, are greeted by merrymakers with silly jokes and swirly rainbow suckers. The smell of buttery popcorn fills the air. Roaring trumpets fill the ears. Flossy cotton candy melts on the tongue. The circus is about to begin. One of the delighted spectators is Deborah Jo Myers, who nominated the circus as one of the nicest places in America. As a teenager, she used to fly through the air here with the greatest of ease. Now she watches kitty clowns spill into the arena, wearing curly rainbow wigs and big red shoes, trying hard to remember their choreography to the pump-up anthem blaring from the speakers. The resulting performance is funnier than anything a real clown could script. Next, unicyclists pedal out, grasping one another's shoulders to form long chorus lines that rotate around the circular ring like hands on a clock. Then, finally, comes the flying trapeze. Star aerialist Kevin Nord, a new graduate of Maconaqua High School, flips and twists, soaring high above the crowds before diving toward his friend's outstretched hands. Caught! The 1,500 spectators erupt with applause for Nord, for all 200 youth performers, for the local 400 volunteers who make the whole thing possible. Since 1960, crop after crop of Peru-area young people have taken their turn in the ring, often returning to help make the Peru Amateur Circus a bit better than it was the year before. "So many things have evolved," says Myers, "and it's all happened strictly through the efforts of volunteers and the people who wanted it sustained." Peru Circus Center Arena, a big top-shaped building in the center of town, is just a block from the train tracks that bisect the little city of 11,000 residents. The railroad, which still runs today, hauling car parts and other freight across the state, is key to Peru's sustained identity. Back in the 19th and early 20th centuries, traveling acts like Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus and the homegrown Hagenbeck Wallace Circus turned Peru into their winter headquarters, taking advantage of the three train lines that converged there. Performers and menageries of hippos, elephants, zebras, and camels called Peru home during the off-season. They, along with hundreds of rail cars holding tents and poles, were ready to take off in any direction for the next cross-country run. By World War II, the last circus car had rolled away, but many of the performers stayed. Today, Peru is home to generations of aerialists, clowns, stagehands, and more. After all, the show must go on. "The circus is what makes us who we are," says Myers. "We wouldn't be on the map without it." In the years that followed, school children put on amateur circus performances, tumbling across the courthouse lawn. By 1968, residents had raised enough money to convert an old lumber yard into the arena. "Once you get involved in the circus, you don't really get uninvolved," says Jason Yu, who spent years on a trapeze. He still volunteers every year during city circus days the week-long festival in July when local circus kids perform the skills they've been working on since February. For many, the mentorship and structure of daily practice can be an absolute lifeline. There are plenty of kids who don't have good situations at home, and they can go to the circus with people who genuinely care about their safety, says you. They can genuinely excel in an environment like that. Myers knows the feeling well. When she was 11, her parents divorced, her father was arrested, her grandfather died, and she was moving houses and schools all in the same year. I'd leave school knowing I was coming home to chaos, Myers says. But I also knew as soon as I got home, I got to change my clothes and come to circus practice. The kids sometimes come to the Big Top for Friday lock-ins. A late night spent chatting on the mats allows them to bond, not just as performers, but as people. Showtime. Nord, a perfect Midwestern gentleman who was studying mechanical engineering at Purdue University, flies with the unencumbered lightness of someone with all the confidence in the world that the person on the opposing trapeze or swing is going to catch him. And why wouldn't he? The small group of aerialists he spent the spring and summer training with, some of them classmates he'd never spoken with at school, are the people he trusts with everything. Nord doesn't struggle as much with pre-show jitters before this year's special 65th anniversary show, themed Make It Shine, to commemorate the milestone. He comes out in his costume and sparkly white cape, ready to twist and tumble and flip. When he sticks the landing, the audience cheers. When he doesn't, they cheer louder. And now the second piece from The Nicest Places in America. Greetings from Semicolon Books by Celeste McCauley. Leslie Shogren wanted to go to Semicolon Books in Chicago to celebrate her birthday. So she packed up her husband and four sons and came in from the suburbs. When she checked out that day in July 2020, she asked the woman at the register if she was Danielle Moore, the bookstore's owner. "Yeah, are you Leslie?" Moore replied, flashing her signature bright smile. She slipped Shogren a birthday card signed by each staff member, thanking her for celebrating her birthday at the store. "Mom, that's a real birthday card," said one of her sons, looking surprised. Shogren was surprised, too. Sure, she had messaged the store on Instagram asking its hours and casually mentioning she'd be visiting for her birthday, but still. "Danielle didn't need to do that," she says. "When people do a hospitality touch like that above and beyond, it just sticks with you." She and her family are store regulars today. Since 2019, Moore has been adding her personal touch to everything she does at Semicolon. Inside, shelves stretch from floor to ceiling, with front-facing books displayed like art. The walls are packed with prints, paintings, and quotes. Comfy couches invite visitors to read, and handmade pillows featuring literary icons like Audre Lorde and Octavia E. Butler add to the homey vibe. "We wanted it to feel cozy, warm, and full of love," she says. Courtney Joseph started going to Semicolon in June 2020. After George Floyd was killed, she wanted to support black-owned businesses. Now a mom, she often brings her toddler to the store. "What I see are people talking to one another," Joseph says about her fellow Semicolon bibliophiles. "There is a sense of connection." It's important to Moore that customers consider the store a third space, not home or work, but some place that still feels like a place for belonging. That's something Moore didn't have growing up when she lived with her mother in a domestic violence shelter in Florida. A Danielle Steele novel was the only book there. "I know what it's like not to have books," she says. Moore welcomes classes into the store, and students pick out what they want for free. So far, through its Clear the Shelves program, Semicolon has given 13,000 books to Chicago Public Schools students. Moore and her staff have curated books for 52 schools, and donated books and funds to 27 Chicagoland organizations. "We like to take everything we make and give it back," she says. Devonta Boston, founder of the nonprofit TGI Movement, which brings youth development program ranging from the arts to entrepreneurship to young people in Chicago's South Side, appreciates what Semicolon does for local kids. Danielle found books our kids had never seen in school, books on streetwear and black fashion designers like Virgin Abloh and Farrell, she says. Semicolon sits in Westtown, a trendy area full of small shops, restaurants, and museums, with a diverse mix of whites, blacks, Asians, Hispanics, and mixed-race folks. Moore lives close enough to the store that she walks to work. Andrea Beschel of Deltronics, a nearby audio electronics repair shop, says Moore makes the whole street feel like a neighborhood. She was the first business owner who came in and interacted with us and invited us to stuff, so that was really cool. She brings a good spirit to the block, adds Cesar Buendia, owner of neighboring Rubens Unisex Barbershop. She came in and offered us books, but we were remodeling. She said she'll come back when we're done. His clients will peruse the books as they wait. Leslie Shogren attended Semicolon's Independent Bookstore Day event last April, a big block party. "There was music," she says. "My husband and I sat on one of the couches they put in the street on a rug and just hung out and chatted with everyone." "It's a very welcoming place," says Aura Sawyer, who is one of many regulars. "You sit there and you can talk about books, you can talk about arts, you can talk about anything." The store's name is also a sign of Moore's irrepressible spirit. In January 2019, she was diagnosed with ocular melanoma. She was a museum curator at the time, constantly flying for work. Chemo would keep her grounded. That's how she landed on Semicolon. A semicolon is where an author could stop the sentence, but chooses not to. "So it was kind of a space for me to figure out a way to still make life enjoyable," she explains. Moore had what she hopes will be her last chemo treatment in June. And that's not the only challenge. Her car was stolen on Labor Day weekend last year. The store's checkbook was taken, and her account was hacked. Those were funds for payroll, book giveaways, school visits, and events. 4 months later, Moore had to shut the store down. She shared the news on Instagram. When she looked at the comments, she felt undone by hundreds of responses. "This is the first bookstore my baby had ever been to at 4. He loves to read now as a 7-year-old. Thank you for lighting the flame. Your work and impact on your community will stand for generations. I owe so much to my inspiration, dream, and aspirations to y'all." A Kickstarter campaign launched to reopen the store. Moore's team checked the numbers constantly. "It was an exciting moment for them to see we were going to make it," she says. Thrilled customers sent DMs saying, "You hit it," and "We can't wait to go to the cafe." Semicolon had its grand reopening this past Juneteenth. Customers brought books to swap with one another. Coffee brewed as a DJ spun music. A photographer snapped portraits of people holding their favorite books. Leah Johnson, who owns Loudmouth Books in Indianapolis, says she is heartened by Semicolon's staying power. "It breaks my heart that people don't always see that bookstores, particularly black bookstores, can offer what no algorithm can offer. And that's the human connection. That's the community building. That's the space making that happens when you support your local bookstore," she says. Finally, fittingly, the best-selling book at Semicolon is All About Love by Bell Hooks. "That is absolutely our ethos," Moore says. "We live by it. We believe in moving in love and community above all." Lastly, and again from the Reader's Digest, from their True Stories column, "Welcome Home. The best part about leaving? Coming back," by Reader's Digest readers. reporting for daddy duty. After a 10-month tour in Afghanistan, my son, Christopher, was reunited with his daughter, Catherine. They hadn't seen each other since she was 9 months old. Amid all the hugging and kissing at the airport, Catherine was staring at her dad, trying to figure out who he was. When Christopher noticed her quietly looking at him, he said, "Let's take a walk and get reacquainted." He took her tiny hand and led her around the terminal. 20 minutes later, Daddy and daughter returned to the group, laughing, the best of friends. By Dorothy Gable, from Clifton Park, New York. Bringing home the baking. I studied education at the University of Colorado, more than 1,000 miles from my home in Illinois, so I didn't get to visit my family often. When I came home after my first semester, I stepped in the door, and all my brothers enthusiastically called out requests for their favorite recipes of mine that they'd been craving. Chocolate chip cookies, quiche Lorraine, blueberry coffee cake, a huge ice cream sundae we called the kitchen sink. My mom greeted me with a laugh, saying, "I guess they missed you." By Jody Emery from Lafayette, Colorado. Doggone it! Whether you're gone for 5 weeks or 5 minutes, a dog will meet your return with equal enthusiasm. My beagle was no exception when I came home from the hospital after giving birth. She was wriggling around, wagging her tail and barking, until she heard the baby and the carrier I'd set on the kitchen table. She jumped on a chair, sniffed around, looked at the baby, then whipped around with betrayal in her big puppy eyes as if to say, "How could you?" By Laurie Strand from Scottsdale, Arizona. A banner return. We'd moved to Baltimore for my husband's veterinary residency, and he had to spend a few extra months there to finish the program while our family settled back home in the country. We hung a giant poster at the top of the steps. It read, "Welcome home to the best teller of tall tales, driving instructor-to-be, golfing buddy, bluegrass fan, Spanish consultant, pet adopter, financial advisor, yoga poser, pug lover, computer wizard, mandolin player, garage organizer, and more." When he walked through the door, his stressed countenance instantly dissolved into a smile. By Danae Babbitt from Maidens, Virginia. We've run out of time for today's episode of Reader's Digest. Today's program is supported by the Durham Lions Club. We hope you enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I'm Diane Edelman, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Reader's Digest is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.